Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco overlooking the Bay, and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Dick Walker. He's Professor Emeritus of Geography at UC Berkeley. He's written lots of books about the history of the San Francisco Bay Area, and he's written the latest book here on tech and the dark side of prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. The actual name of the book is Pictures of a Gone City. Thank you very much for coming, Dick.
My pleasure. Well, I can see that the Commonwealth Club operates like the San Francisco Giants. They advertise us as a sellout, but there's still a lot of empty seats. But I thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. It's a wonderful view, too, and if I start to get distracted, that's probably why. So today I want to talk to you about what's happened to the Bay Area. This is not a talk about San Francisco. I know most San Franciscans are obsessed about the city, but this is about the Bay Area as a whole, which is 10 times the city of San Francisco. What I've tried to do in this book, Pictures of a Gone City, which, by the way, is based on a poem by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, which I repeat in the front piece. What I try to do in this is show that this place is extraordinarily contradictory. It is, on the one hand, one of the great success stories of the present day world economy, culture, innovation, and so on. We hear that a lot. I hear praise to the stars, and with good reason. You know, it's rich, it's been fast growing, it attracts a lot of wonderful people, it has a rich culture, a wonderful political history, and it's beautiful, thanks in part to conservation movement, which I'll mention later. So what could be wrong? Well, quite a lot could be wrong. And a lot of people are very upset that live in the Bay Area or used to live in the Bay Area because a lot of the wonderful things have a dark side. And that's what I try to do in this book is present a fair-minded picture of the success and failures of the San Francisco Bay Area. And I think it's an important kind of lesson because as one of the most successful places in the world, if we can't solve certain deep problems here, then how are we going to solve them? So the deep problems that plague the U.S. and more generally the world economy and capitalism are in many ways focused here, they concentrated here in a way that's quite revealing. And it's also a challenge because it's very easy to go to a place that's not doing well in Indiana and say, oh, see, economy's not doing well, it's unjust, things are bad, people are treated badly, and so on. And that may be true. It's much harder, and this was my task, to look at one of the most successful places and say, but wait a second, what's going on behind the scenes that we're not facing up to? And that's the dark side. The tech part, of course, tech is so prominent. The tech industry is so prominent here, and it colors almost everything we talk about. But it's not everything, as I will say. All right. So the way it's going to be organized here is around four sections of the book. The book has 10 chapters, four sections. The first thing I'll talk about is the economy. The first couple of chapters are about that. Second thing I'll talk about is inequality in class and race. That's the next couple of chapters. Then in the middle of the book, there are three chapters about the city, about space. I'm a geographer, so I want to see how things work out spatially. And it tells us a lot about how the system operates, how society operates. And then finally, I want to look at some of the challenges for the future that we're, I'm trying to experiment with my phone here to not go over the limit. We'll see if it works. So the last part is about the future and the challenges presented by climate change, by living in tech world, and by the politics of present-day America. So let's talk first about tech industry, which sort of, you know, looms large over everything we talk about in the Bay Area. We are the world center of tech. So the first thing I want to do when I on each point here is I'm going to say kind of the basic reality, the side of glowing reality. Then I'll say something about the mythology that has arisen, and then talk about some of the harsher, bleaker realities behind that. So the glowing reality is we're the world center of tech and have been for 50 years at least. And that's quite something. Where this place and its companies and its workers and tech are transforming the world. And it's also the leading motor of economic development in the Bay Area. And it's also the leading motor transforming our city. So that's not really a challenge. But what happens is there's a mythology. When we say, why is this happening? Of course, the mythology that's so important to the business class is that this is based on the great innovators, the entrepreneurs, and the startups. And what I do is I look at behind that. That is just the frosting on the cake. It's a very deep cake, and it has at least five layers that little mythology does not cover. And the first one is that this place and the technology industry is just saturated with finance. There's money that comes in from all over the world, literally, to invest in these startups. So, you may have a good idea and you may be a genius, but you will be usually awash with money pretty quickly if you have even a remotely good idea. Secondly, it's not all about little startups, as important as those may be. It's also about monster corporation, because the successful startups of yesteryear have become the monster corporations of today, as we all know. And they're just as important, and they're also very innovative in their own way, often. And they gobble up the startups, so they play a very important role in the whole ecology of the future of every little startup and how you become a millionaire and so on. The third thing is that something that we economic geographers study intensively, which is the power of economic agglomeration economies, the power of the whole. This is a collective operation involving small and large firms interacting intensely, hundreds of firms literally doing different bits and pieces of the whole, and like an ecosystem, a lot of people like to use that metaphor now, it's much greater than any individual firm, individual startup, individual even tech giant. Behind that even, of course, is the technology itself. Electronics and information technology are very powerful. They are the leading edge of modern technology, as we essentially all know. But it's very fecund. You can do a lot of these innovation in a lot of startups precisely because of the nature of the nature of being able to play with electronics and play with digital operations and so on. And what's more, contrary to what George just said, electronics has a deep history. There's a century-long development of technology going back to the inventor of the vacuum tube, from which all modern electronics emerges, Lee DeForest down in Palo Alto. And finally, there are the workers, the creative workers and the rest of the workers who participate, who actually do the work, who actually create things, who are in the tens and hundreds of thousands in this industry. So forget the mythology. The industry does work, but it works in a way that's quite different than what we often think. Okay, my second point is about the economy as a whole. It is much more than technology. The tech sector is about 10% of the Bay Area economy. This is a wonderfully diverse, rich, giant urban economy. And the big urban economies are the ones that are conquering the world economy today. It is the biggest cities that are growing the fastest. We're not alone. And we have a number of very successful, dynamic sectors, whether it's tourism and entertainment and eating out and all that, or it's healthcare or education, higher education especially, research, biotech. Even we have quite a bit of manufacturing. Commerce, this is a huge commercial center. Management, business services really means management, corporate management for far-flung operations around the world, including of the tech corporations. So this is a very rich economy, and it has grown like crazy. So that just in the 2010s, it grew from about $550 billion GDP to almost $800 billion, making it a larger economy than the Netherlands or Turkey. It's about 18th in the world, and it's third in the U.S. among big cities. So the GDP per person is by far the highest of any city, any place in the United States, probably any place in the world. It's kind of an extraordinary record. And it grew in less than 10 years by almost 50%. So what a stunning record. So the mythology, however, is, well, we're doing so well because we're so great. And we did it. You know, it's the usual mythology in capitalism. You know, the rich people deserve it because they're so smart, and the poor people don't because they're so dumb or they're lazy or whatever. It's kind of the same thing. Why are we successful and Southern Indiana isn't? Well, it's because the world has changed and industries have changed. Capitalism keeps shape-shifting. And with new industries, new sectors, we're the winners in that lottery. And Southern Indiana is one of the losers. And those industries that used to populate all the smaller cities and towns around the Midwest have disappeared. They've either concentrated elsewhere, been defeated by international competition, or they just don't do, you know, who buys like the Nabisco plant in Oakland? How many people eat shredded wheat? You know, that's not really... 53 different cereals, and besides, most people are now eating, you know, something down at Starbucks or whatever, you know. So the world changes, and places get left behind. And this has been going on in capitalism for 200 years. Go to Northern England, where the Industrial Revolution began. And a lot of it's just beautiful rural areas. You can't see anything of those hated furnaces, you know, that William Blake wrote about. What's the phrase? The infernal furnaces? No. Dark satanic mills. See, what an educated public we have here at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you. So, I want to make a number of points about that quickly, because I'm timing myself. And that is that those two things are not unrelated. It's not just the world's change and we gain. We literally suck resources, people, talent, money out of the failing places. This is an old principle of uneven development. And we are the winners. So we are the brain gain. The brains of the world come running in here to work in tech or higher education or whatever it is. Oh, stop that. But money flows too. The amount of excess money that cascades into this place. I did some research back in the .com boom of the 90s, and when it collapsed, we discovered that 40% of all the stock value in, at that point, the greatest stock market bubble in history was in Bay Area companies. That's unbelievable, $7 trillion. That means it isn't just that our companies are productive and they have wonderful products. It also means that just money just gushes in here. Where does it come from? Other places. So we suck talent, labor, you know, immigrants, what the greatest deal on earth. Get an immigrant and you get the cheapest labor. And that immigrant may be the lowest kind of unskilled labor, or you get skilled labor coming in from, you know, great education universities in India. And you get it for nothing. What a deal, contrary to the Trumpian view of immigration. Okay, so my third point, I want to move on to inequality in class, because the situation is we're also the richest urban area on Earth per capita. Our average income is around $100,000 a person, far ahead of London, New York, you know, any big city. And obviously, you can pick a little thing like Hartford, Connecticut, and say, oh, that's higher. But I'm talking about this 8.5 million person, 12-county Bay Area here. So that's an extraordinary figure. And it works to the advantage of lots of people. It pulls up. Here, the average income being the highest, that if you're, all other things given, on average, every worker here, every person, skilled or unskilled, white or black, female, male, earns more in the same job than in any other city in America. Wow, that sounds great. High income, high average income. That must mean everybody's all right. Well, the mythology, of course, you all know, that prosperity lifts all boats. The old, one of the oldest saws of the modern world and of capitalist apologetics. Well, it doesn't. And what we see this in the Bay Area is the massive growth of inequality, just like we see everywhere around the United States. So here we are. Oh, we're so rich, we must be equal. Uh-uh. And our inequality is peculiar because we don't have a huge cheap labor force. What we have is inequality growing at the top. So we're one of the top four most unequal cities in America. And I say city in the largest sense. And it's mostly at the top. Now, it's hard, you know, you can get wealth statistics. There's been some very good economic research recently about the growth of the 1%, how much they own, and so on. And, of course, it's shocking. And you can't get that for the Bay Area. But what you can get is a proxy, like the fact that we have more billionaires per capita than any other metropolitan area in America. We're second in billionaires only to New York, which is, of course, twice or three times the size. The only city in the world that seems to come close is Hong Kong, because Chinese millionaires moved to Hong Kong. So it's unbelievable. And in other kind of measures, 1%ers, because that's a different measure, millionaires, and so on, the Bay Area comes out on top. So that's what we're mostly growing. Now, the top 5% is off the charts. Top 10, 20% is probably, again, we don't have really good comparison, but they've done really well in the last 20, 30 years, as around the country, but even better. So our top, you know, small business owners, big professionals like doctors, lawyers, that kind, you know, skilled workers at the top, and we all know about Facebook pays an average of $250,000 roughly per worker, they say. That's because they farm out all their cheap labor. But it does mean that skilled workers working in tech and also, you know, university professors at Cal and Stanford are very well paid. Well, once they get old like me. So the inequality is striking, and actually we have this thing called a Gini coefficient, an income inequality measure that's about the same as Guatemala. Oh, so we're really great, aren't we? All right, so which leads us to talk about the problem of class, which, of course, Americans freak out the minute you say the word class. But it's a great old word. Oh, there it goes. Oh, shush. It's a great old word. And the reality is that we have this, you know, very rich, very big top capitalist class. We have a very substantial, what you might call upper middle class, that is the professionals, the very highly skilled workers, and so on. But then we have a working class. And who are they, and how are they doing? And they are the other three quarters, 80%. Who are they? Well, they don't get talked about very much in this glowing success story. Well, okay, high average incomes, does that translate to everybody doing well? We have a quarter of our workers are minimum wage. Now, that's better than Atlanta, but that's not saying much. It's better than LA, even. But it's still kind of surprising. A third of our workers are less than a living wage. The middle third are stagnant wages and have been for 30, 40, 50 years, just like across America. Now, it's true that employment grew like crazy. The positive of this, I kind of broke up my formatting, sorry. The positive is, you know, we've attracted tens, hundreds of thousands of new workers. We pay them well on average. And where our unemployment rate has been low for the last 8 years. It started just diving after 2010, the fastest recovery from the Great Recession of any place in America. But how are those workers doing? How's that working class doing? Well, obviously a lot of people are struggling. And you see it in things like struggles for getting living wage ordinances, unionized battles for things like the food service workers who are making the food to take over to Facebook down in Silicon Valley, which are very cleverly subcontracted so that Facebook looks like it has a much higher average income than it really does. Corporations have gotten very smart about subcontracting labor, especially low-end labor, so they don't have to worry about it, they don't have to pay them well, and so on. Now, we have a reasonably high unionization rate, but we see that people are struggling. If you get down, especially down in the bottom third, you see there's a lot of evidence about struggles, especially like single women, single mothers who are trying to make ends meet and so on. And you know, down in Silicon Valley, the food bank did a report recently said 20% of the people have serious hunger problems in the middle of Santa Clara County. Can you believe? Let alone the homeless, which I'm not going to get into because everybody talks about homelessness. But that's just like the scum at the bottom of the tank. But workers, ordinary full-time workers, are struggling like crazy. Now, another thing I want to say about the workers is in California, something dramatic has happened. And it's happening across the country now, and it is part of the discombobulation of a lot of white Americans, which is that the working class in California is two-thirds people of color, 60% to two-thirds, depending on where you are. A little higher in Southern California, a little lower here, but very striking. It's mostly immigrants and their children, because our African-American population in the Bay Area is relatively small, relatively speaking. It's still large, except in Silicon Valley, where they never hired them. Very interesting. So those wonderful social Democrats down in Silicon Valley. All right. So those people are struggling, and we see their struggles through not only struggles for union and living wages, at McDonald's and so on, but also through the battles about criminalization, because your kids, black and brown kids, so many of them are in jail and have been because this was such a carceral state for so long. The struggle over immigrant rights, because every immigrant and their family has somebody they know, somebody in the extended family who's being deported or in danger of being deported. So these are ruminating down below. These are bubbling down below, these kind of activism, because things are not hunky-dory for those people. But it is interesting because the image, when I say the word working class, like a good old Marxist that I am, you know, people go, oh, you know, that's white people in West Virginia. Well, it's not. And that's a completely misleading view of who the workers are today. Now, do they constitute a coherent class? That's another question. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about, though, is this middle part of the book about the urbanization process. Okay, what's the implications of all this for the urbanization process? How is it lived out in spatially, geographically? Well, one of the things we observed that's so striking that I talk about in the fifth chapter is, boy, San Francisco is just, you know, what a great place it's become. It's just full of cafes and restaurants and the good life, the urban, cosmopolitan life is at your fingertips. And even in Silicon Valley, which is like one of the most boring places on earth, I grew up there, so I can say that. You know, even downtown Mountain View is getting kind of interesting. And Palo Alto, where I grew up, because I grew up in the gilded ghetto of Palo Alto, being one of the favorite children of the white, not working class, that now has got kind of interesting. And it used to be like bore, it was so boring that when the first Round Table Pizza opened up in Menlo Park, that was a big event for us teenagers. That was, by the way, the first Round Table Pizza, just for you historians. Anyway, so what's happening is we're getting this massive transformation of the old central cities. It's now hitting Oakland, massive waves of people moving out of San Francisco, moving into Oakland, Oakland getting richer, white people. We call it gentrification. But I call it kind of a class conquest of space. The upper classes get to choose where they live. They want to live close to work. They want to live in the nicest places. And bingo, they get to choose. They can pay the highest rents. They can pay the most for houses, sometimes cash down. And guess who can't? The working people. We'll get back to housing. But basically, on average in the Bay Area, only the top 20% can afford the median house in the Bay Area. And rents are even worse. Okay. So this is not as pretty a picture as it looks. It's this new urbanism, which is great. I love it. Transforming some very dowdy areas and, you know, like the San Francisco waterfront. Look how much it's improved in terms of strolling and eating and kind of pleasuring, right, for the upper classes, basically. And this is true again and again around the Bay Area. But not without conflict, let me tell you. Not without conflict, because the other side of it, you know, mythology is, oh, this is all great. But the other side there is that tens of thousands of people, of households have been evicted in San Francisco, another tens of thousands in Oakland, and so on. We don't even have figures in other cities, but it's bad. Displacement, there's a research project at Berkeley now trying to enumerate the displacement by just rising prices as housing goes out through the roof. And literally hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced from their homes. Now, it's fine when you're trying to pick up a home, a nice home, because you've got some income in San Francisco, say, but the people who are displaced, they lose their home, they lose their neighborhood, they lose their friends and the familiarity. Older people, it's devastating. And then you add the foreclosures back in 2008, 9, 10, and you just got a massive transformation of the Bay Area that is, by the way, where a lot of the old neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods, barrios, that we used to call ghettos and barrios, which are not such bad words, by the way, because they're evocative. And instead, we talk about, oh, the inner city, you know. But those people are popping up now in Antioch, Brentwood, as far away as Stockton, Modesto, Turlock. It's unbelievable. And people are commuting back 2 hours each way. We have the most long-distance commutes in the country. What does that mean for people's lives? It's devastating for many, 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 many people, working people. And, you know, people like teachers. You know, you have small businesses in San Francisco that are closing down because they can't get cheap labor. That's because those people can't afford to live in San Francisco anymore. San Francisco has the lowest percentage of black people of any big city in America because they've been displaced, first by foreclosure crisis, which was worse in California than anywhere, by the way, and now gentrification. Okay, so next thing for us, housing. Everybody wants to talk about housing, so I'm not going to talk about it too long, but the reality is that, I guess, I don't know how to say the positive. because there isn't a positive. What there is staggering statistics. By the way, my book is just packed with charts, statistics, but it's surprisingly readable. And it's long, but it sits lightly in your hand. So I definitely recommend reading it, because if you don't believe, if you think I'm just blowing it out my ears, like some presidents, I actually back it up with a ton of facts. So our housing prices are probably the highest in the U.S. We passed Manhattan. San Francisco passed Manhattan. The Bay Area passed New York a long time ago. Highest in the world. I think we're a little behind Singapore and Vancouver and Hong Kong, especially in affordability. And those statistics are pretty iffy internationally, but nationally, we have one of the lowest affordability rates, which, again, as I said, maybe 20% of the people can afford to live in the Bay Area, not San Francisco. 2% of the people, I don't know what percent, 5% can afford to live in San Francisco if you're moving in. That's in the Bay Area as a whole. That includes way out there. It goes all the way out. It's 12 counties now. It goes to Stockton. It's like, you know, 50, 75 miles, 100 miles in every direction except the Pacific. Okay. The mythology. Our housing prices are high because of the oppositional movements, people protesting building in their neighborhoods. This is bullshit. That's a technical term we economic geographers use. This is based on this most simplistic economic models, and it's paraded everywhere, and basically all our legislators and all our legislative analysis and McKinsey company and my colleagues in the economics department all buy this. Oh, it's supply and demand. The problem is the restriction of supply. That's why prices are going up. No, it's not. It's because demand is out of control. And housing is not Tinker Toys. It's not even iPhones. You can't produce more quickly. It's a very slow process. It has always been a slow process. They are big, lumpy things. Houses, buildings, apartment buildings, they take a lot of finance. They take a lot of architecture. They take a lot of planning. You do have to get your permits, and that is hardly the only thing. And in fact, permits in the Bay Area are running ahead of the actual building. So the whole YIMBY idea that this is the fault of the opponents in the Mission District or something is wrong. Yes, there are opponents. Yes, there are cases where I don't agree with them, where their opposition I don't agree with, particularly Palo Alto, Orinda, Burlingame. These are places that protect themselves really carefully from a lot of uncontrolled building. But when the Mission District does it, we all get hysterical and say, oh, it's see what they're doing? Okay, that's not doing it. You have a situation of unbelievably rapid growth, unbelievably well-off workers and upper class who can pay. Plus, add, you know, there's just money running around investing. A lot of REITs, real estate investment funds, buying up apartment houses, evicting people, and profiting from it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So, now, of course, there are things you could do to deal with Palo Alto. There are problems of I shake my head at opponents in Berkeley a lot because they're so naive. This is a big city. It's getting bigger. It's got to get denser. You got to build more housing. We are building more housing. The Bay Area comes in above average amongst the big cities in America in terms of the amount of new housing built in this boom. It's always delayed. because that's how housing works. It responds slowly to the boom. Then it goes, then they start building like crazy. You get cranes everywhere. And then you overbuild, particularly in office buildings. And then in the next crisis, you go, oh, God. But you don't keep building. It all stops. Okay, so that's housing. Next point is about the metropolitan area as a whole. Now, we're very focused in San Francisco and the East Bay about what's going on in the central city, about the struggles over density, struggles over new housing, you know, the cranes everywhere and so on, and the beautiful, and of course, all the restaurants and the wonderful urbanity. And we think, okay, that's the action. But this has always been highly spread out, low-density metropolitan area. I was surprised a couple of years ago when I looked at the figures, because I don't know if you know what the densest metropolitan area in America is now. No, it's Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles. Second is the Bay Area. Second is New York, greater New York. Third is the Bay Area. Surprise, surprise. That's because, of course, all Americans, we all think Manhattan, but greater New York just go, New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island, it's all over the place. So these are really low-density cities. So the third most highest density city in America turns out on world scale to be 820-something. We're not very dense. So we need to get denser. I'm all for that. So I'm not anti-building any of that. I do think you have to control building. I think you have to control, otherwise developers run amok and they build cruddy stuff and they build it in the wrong place. It falls apart. You have to have zoning and building controls. Now, what is the Bay Area doing? It's just, you know, in some ways it's a success story. It's 8.5 million, 12 people, 12 counties. It's the fourth biggest metropolitan area in the U.S. So we can go, well, we're fourth. You know, we're only after Chicago. That's pretty impressive, you know. And you'll see a lot of misbegotten figures because we're such a spread out, divided up metropolitan area. It gets miscounted all the time. But that's the actual, you know, new census definition of the consolidated metropolis. So that seems impressive, but what has it meant for us? Incredible sprawl is still going on despite all our environmental controls. Our transportation system is totally overwhelmed, and the air pollution as a result of vehicles, which are the main source of air pollution, means we're still the sixth worst air quality in America. Great. Well, we're not fourth. We're six, so we're a little better. Plus, our air blows into the San Joaquin Valley, which is the worst air in America. We also take our garbage out there and dump it. That's a whole other issue, what we do out there. The sprawl is hitting the Central Valley and farther away areas and transforming them in ways that people sitting in San Francisco are just not aware of, and so on and so on. I might add that this is, by many measures, for many years, this was the least segregated metropolitan area in America. That, unfortunately, is not saying enough or much in many cases. Oakland's pretty good, but even it is quite segregated between certain neighborhoods and others. The recent study at Berkeley argues, as one can clearly see, that with the problem of housing prices, we're becoming more segregated. And that's by class as well as by race. So that's going the wrong way. It's getting reworked because, say, for example, so many African Americans have moved to Stockton or moved to Brentwood or Antioch. Okay, so, we don't have a ghetto in Bayview anymore because it's all gentrified. So, but where's that new concentration popping up far away? So we need to look at the whole metropolitan area and the problems it presents. Next thing I want to talk about, how am I doing on time? Oh, not too bad. I want to talk about this last section of the book. And these are tough problems. They're kind of, you know, the most speculative in some ways, the hardest to get your head around. So I pose them as sort of problems of the future, except that they're here. And that is environment, climate change, living in tech world that we've created, and politics. And when I started writing the book a couple of years ago, I would say none of these was as present in the public mind as today. Most of you being well-educated and well-read and kind of up-to-date on politics, tech problems with the tech companies and so on, probably know a lot more about this than I do. But what I discovered was pretty disturbing. Okay, let's start with the environment. The environment, we had the greatest environmental movement in the world for a century. The Bay Area was the leading green place, green spaces. We created unbelievable open space. We saved the Bay. It's a marvel. I wrote a whole book on it because I wanted to know how political movement could be so successful. And it was pretty upper class, but it brought in a lot of workers as well. It was pretty white and rich, but a lot of people of color have really loved the parks and used them, vote for the bonds and so on. Pretty positive story. Get to the age of climate change. Well, how are we doing? Not as well as we should be, by a long shot. Our city is spilling in the Central Valley. Okay, we have all this beautiful open space here. What about Central Valley? Not so much. Our air pollution from vehicles, not good. How about our energy use? Now, on that front, California has done excellently, going back to the 1970s, the first appearance of Jerry Brown, and a lot of radicals from the Bay Area who were in his administration, like Sim Vanderin, real innovative thinkers. And the Bay Area has cut its energy use and its water use back in the 1970s, so that we look like Germany rather than the United States. So we should be proud of that. And a lot of new innovations about solar power, batteries from that crazy man, Elon Musk, and so on, that, I think we can be quite proud of, designing LEED buildings and so on. The mythology is, though, that we did it, we're okay, everything's fine. And we're up to, we're up to snuff. Well, with climate change, we're not. And we face a number of really intense problems. One of them is water. Well, the Bay Area kind of sips water, but California doesn't, because agribusiness uses 80% of it. I mean, we sip water. Of course, we destroyed half of Yosemite Park to get it. Minor problem, but we didn't have anything to do with that, right? No historical guilt. So even if we drink it to this day. So what are we doing about water? Well, we haven't stopped agribusiness's overconsumption of water. Jerry Brown wants to build these tunnels, and they're going ahead. And what have we done to stop it? How have we changed the whole way California uses water? We haven't. Sorry. What about rising sea levels? Well, we must be prepared. We got some experiments, some activities. BCDC, Bay Conservation Development Council, is definitely on top of this to a remarkable degree. But are the cities around the Bay? I have a friend who talks regularly to city officials. In Alameda, they have no idea that, a 1 foot rise in sea level, which we'll get, it's going to be 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, it's coming, plus storm surges. Alameda, you're going to be walking in your boots, your hip boots, through 30 days a year. What have we done in San Francisco? Oh, San Francisco's so up to date with its environmental department and so on. What have we done? Built all these high rises at sea level. Walk outside the Commonwealth Club, you smell poop. That's because the sewers don't drain, because there's no place for them to go. They have to be pumped out here. What happens with just a foot of sea level rise? The sewers don't work. Our sewage plant in East Bay doesn't work. You're going to have to build a giant wall around it. And still, how's the water going to get down? What happens when it all backs up? What happens to BART when the water in a storm, winter storm, high tides, splashes into the Embarcadero Station and starts running to Oakland? What's that going to do to the Bay Area? We haven't faced this stuff at all. What about wildfires? We're doing great on wildfires, right? You know, North Bay burned up last year. What are we going to do? Rebuild it. What are we doing about that urban interface moving into the mountain, the foothills, the far distant areas, all around California? California hasn't faced up to this at all. How are we doing on thinning our forests or thinning the brush? You know, in Oakland Hills, where there was this, one of the greatest fires of American history, you know, for a while they had rules about brush clearing. Now the brush, the trees, people forget, and then it happens again. So we're not doing too well on a number of environmental fronts at all. What about the tech world? We live, we're swimming in tech world. We all know that. In the beginning, there were a lot of promises about how wonderful this is going to be. And it has. It's transformed our lives, transformed the lives of hundreds of millions, if not billions of people. It's given us access to knowledge, to friend networks, to instant information that was undreamed of. You know, you have a computer in your pocket. And most of this is developed here. This place has transformed the world. We have a lot to be proud of, but we have a lot to be responsible for. Now, the mythology is in tech world, of the tech boys, is, of course, they were going to deliver all these utopian, on these utopian promises of, you know, disruption, move fast and break things. We're going to have horizontality. It's all going to be equal now. Everybody's going to, through tech, is going to make us all equal exchange. And then information, access to every kind of information in the world, at your fingertips. Friendship. You can befriend everybody. Have, you know, the world is your village now. How's that worked out? Well, I don't think I need to lecture you people about that, because it hasn't worked out all that well. And what, I mean, I can go through it if you want, but it hasn't worked out all that well. The misinformation, the fact that the information that's being out there gathered on you, as you look at the world and the world's looking, they're looking back at you, is stunning. The effect on democracy and misinformation, the destruction of reliable news media and scurrilous trolls. I mean, are we friendlier? We're actually more hate, we hate each other more. And social media play a big role in that. So it's very dicey. And I don't want to say it's all awful. I'm not saying it's all awful. But we all know there's kind of a dark side to it that needs to be addressed. And the point I want to make about that is that these guys, this is the leading technology of our age. It's transformed the world in the same way railroads did in the 19th century. The automobile did in the 20th century. And so, I mean, I could go on. The chemical industry transformed the world in the 20th century in so many ways. And a lot for better. But there's this kind of fetish of modern technology, newness, utopian, and kind of the utopian ideal of the new that has been around, fundamental to the idea of modernity for 200, even 300 years. And it's a religion of capitalism. It's the one, in some ways, the religion of capitalism, that the new is going to deliver you. It's going to solve our human problems. It's technology can solve everything. And it's really the same old, what one author called the technological sublime. And Americans just love it. And we here in the Bay Area just love it. But what it means is, more practically, is that for 20 years, any new technologies, at least, maybe 50 years, gets a free pass. Everybody goes, wow, or they don't know what to say. It just kind of overwhelms us. We humans love new things. And politically, nobody does anything. They get a free pass from every level of government. And then 20, 30 years later, we go, oh, damn, what was that? Maybe we should have done something about that. Maybe the railroads should have standardization. Maybe railroads should have rate controls. Maybe we shouldn't just give money to the Big Four to build a railroad. Maybe they're the octopus and not just the deliverers of the Transcontinental Railroad. And so on and so on. Every age has this new wave of technologies that get a free pass, and then we wake up. And if we don't wake up, of course, things run wild. And this is the time people are waking up, and we'll see how it ends up. It depends on social movements and governmental regulation, how this is going to end up, you know? But right now, we're still in a stage where scooters just appear everywhere. And we go, damn, what happened? What are we going to do with that? And then we go, oh, well, now we're getting better. Pull them off the streets for a little while we figure out what to do with them. That's a lot better than what we did with Facebook. We didn't say, oh, pull that off for a while and we'll think about how well this is going to work. Nope. Finally, I just want to talk briefly about politics. I've done 50 minutes. It's not too bad. And then I'll be done. Bay Area has a very proud political tradition, progressive tradition in many ways, many flaws along the way. Don't get me started about what we did to the Native Americans and so on. But there's an honorable tradition here, which in many ways has been ahead of the rest of the country in many, many times over the long haul since the gold rush. And, hit a kind of peak in the 1960s when people called us the Left Coast. You know, and I think we have reason to be kind of proud of how progressive we are on a number of key issues, whether it's gay rights or racial equality, racial justice, democratic, behaving according to democratic principles, and so on. So, we have a lot to be proud of. And the mythology, though, is that I think we come down today. The other thing we have to be proud of is this is the bluest of blue states, right? And the Bay Area is the bluest of blue places. And we go, see, we're the resistance. In fact, the word resistance comes from George Lucas, who set up shop here, although he's from Modesto. But that's now part of the Bay Area. It wasn't when he grew up. And so now we're all the resistance, and we're kind of proud of that. And there's a lot of great stuff going on that we should be proud of. The mythology, though, I think, is this, that we're enlightened, especially we, i.e. you and me in this room, kind of upper-class professionals, intelligentsia. We're progressive, right? We don't buy into that Trump stuff. We hate him. We hate what he represents. And that's true of us. And what did San Francisco vote against Trump? 90% against? Okay, more power to us. Okay, that's really good. Is it, though, we enlightened upper classes that are actually brought about the blue California? I don't think so. I think we're part of it, but we're only 20% at most. What about that other 80%? What are they like in California, in the Bay Area? Then it gets interesting. Because I think it's not the professionals. I definitely think it's not the techies. There are good techies, bad techies. I don't like to whack on techies. But there are a lot of very young, kind of progressive, young people tend not to be kind of knee-jerk, racist, homophobes, and so on, which is great. But when it comes to politics and economics, they are mostly kind of libertarian and naive. Certainly the big ones are, and a lot of little ones are too. So what has made this the bluest of blue? It's the working class. It's the working people. And if you don't respect the role of the working people, you end up doing what Hillary Clinton did, forgetting about them and thinking you're going to just say, I'm liberal, we're multi-culti, and we professionals are enlightened, and that's going to carry the day. It's not. And as many observers have said, like Joan Williams and others in the Bay Area and elsewhere, Thomas Frank. If you don't build on that solid base of working people, you're not gonna win against Trump and the right. They are a major bulwark. And in California, remember, the working class has changed. Working people are so overwhelmingly of color. And they know. They are sort of social democrats by experience. They think we should have good schools. They think we should have health care. They know the working conditions are crappy and that working wages need to go up. They know that we throw too many people in jail. And those are fundamental progressive positions. And the reason California has flipped from being one of the heartlands of neoliberalism, and I described this at length in my book, after the 60s, it became actually Southern California conquered the Bay Area and brought Reaganism and neoliberalism, or neoconservatism, however you want to call it, to America and then conquered the world with it. It came out of Southern California, came out of California with a little help from compradors like Ed Meese and Dianne Feinstein. Sorry, Dianne. But what happened is the working people here have been actively recruited by unions, actively mobilized by movements, and they learned, the immigrants and their kids learned in Prop 184 that the white people don't really like you, and the upper class people, they think you don't deserve to be here. And they'll do a lot. They'll do whatever they can to exclude you. And they learned a hard lesson. And people then, including my ex-wife, went out and became citizens. And the kids grew up. And they're now this huge majority in California that makes us a blue state. And on that note, I finish. Thank you for being patient.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that are listening to Professor Emeritus Dick Walker speaking upon the dark side of prosperity here in the San Francisco area. We have time for one or two questions.
Yeah, sorry about that, but I'll stick around if people have questions they want to pursue.
Great. So who would like to ask the first question?
Sir.
What do you see 10 years down the road?
Oh, God, those are the worst questions. Those are the worst. What do I say? I mean, it depends. It so much depends on people, you know, getting organized, getting active, and change the way this place is going. That's what I see. And if we don't, I see, you know, I think there's good reason to fear for democracy in America. I think it's that serious. Now, that may be my Bay Area left coast view, but I think it's pretty realistic. And I'm not one of those old lefties who used to cry fascist every moment. But we've got a proto-fascist in the White House, and it's dangerous times. So don't take it lightly. That's my advice.
Next question.
Oh, the other thing I foresee 10 years down is, of course, the boom is going to crash. They always do. We never know quite when and where it's coming from,
what it'll look like,
but it's going to come down. And I have a section in my book about that. It always does. And those who rise high have far to fall.
Do you see much potential for high-speed rail being built and how it can tie in the Bay Area or San Francisco with the San Joaquin Valley? And kind
you
of
must be a
somewhere.
Planner or something. Right? high-speed rail. It was a good idea 30 years ago. They should have built it along. We already had the right-of-way along the California Aqueduct. They could have built it like that for nothing. And instead, they did it too late. They run it down the wrong side of the Central Valley where it costs gazillions. I'd still like to see it built because I think trains are great and make sense. But it's very expensive. What I do think is we've underinvested in infrastructure for a long time. This has been what neoconservatism, neoliberalism did to us. And California, which used to be the most infrastructure-rich state in America, from schools to water systems, I don't agree with all of them, to highways, has been beggaring itself for decades. And we're now, you know, just trying to figure out how to make up for that. The Bay Area doesn't look that good. Statistics I love is that, like, we're very proud because we passed a bond issue for BART about, what, 2-3 years ago for $4 billion, $5 billion. Do you know what LA passed last year for mass transit? $120 billion. LA's bigger than us, but not 20 times as big. They're way ahead of us. And there's another area in which, in the Bay Area, we think we're very cool, but we're very backward on our public transit, mass transit. And that's how you move people in a dense city and in with climate change. Keep your carbon down. Yes, sir.
One more question.
In this big metropolitan Bay Area, are you seeing any models? Is there any parts of this region that are demonstrating something different or offering some sort of way to manage?
Well, it depends on which problem you're talking about. I mean, yeah, there's always bright spots around. You know, I'm going to be on a panel with Lenny Siegel, who's the mayor of Mountain View. He's an old Stanford activist when I was down there. You know, we're both Gilda Ghetto boys. But, you know, he's trying to tax Google. And Cupertino tried to tax Apple. You know, they get beaten back really quickly. But, you know, that's a bright spot. They're working with Google, trying to get Google to actually build housing, which they're kind of going to do. Whereas Apple does nothing. So Google gets some points on that front. So there are bright spots. The regulation, some of the regulations, like of Airbnb in San Francisco. You know, so you got to look around. And of course, I love Oakland. Oakland's politically always kind of a mess, but socially it's fantastic. So if you're talking about social experiments, Oakland's the greatest. So. Berkeley's pretty conservative now, actually. Sorry. Used to be fantastic when I moved here, but I'm an old guy now. It's full of a lot of really overly rich people living in the hills.
Well, that's a different take on Oakland, Berkeley, and San Francisco Bay Area.
I mean, oh, yeah. San Francisco's lost a lot of its political heft because it's gentrified so much. So good luck to you, San Franciscans.
Do you think 20 years from now it'll all be one big city that covers the whole area? San Jose and Oakland? And
well, it already is.
Yeah.
And it just drives me crazy as a geographer how it gets split up in our minds and in all the business reporting and the governmental reporting. So Silicon Valley, as you may have noticed, is no longer down there. There are more startups in San Francisco than in Silicon Valley since 2000. The whole West Bay is basically Silicon Valley with some fingerlings out in places like Pleasanton and the East Bay and Emeryville and so on. So East Bay's less tech crazy and tech based, actually. The East Bay's different. We have sub-regions that really are different and it matters. But we better also think about how we are one big place and that really matters. And you can't just obsess about your little Berkeley or San Francisco problems. You got to think big. And when climate change, those kind of big problems need big thinking. And don't leave it to Elon Musk. And going to Mars is not going to solve our problem. That's not the kind of big thinking I want. You know, Larry Ellison building bigger and bigger houses. Mark Benioff and his bigger and bigger erection over here. That's not the kind of big thinking. I actually like that building. I think it's beautiful. And a lot of people hate it, but I think it's beautiful. However, maybe that's not necessarily the most important big thinking we need. And on that note.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.